Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
What does citizens owe the state? What does the state owe to its citizens?
Thomas Hobbes and the Ideal Citizen.
I wanna be a boss, I wanna be a big boss, I wanna boss the world around, I wanna be the biggest boss that ever bossed the world around.
What's the difference between being a citizen and being a subject?
Well, citizens have a say. Subjects merely obey.
Don't citizens also have to obey?
No, citizens have inviolable rights.
But surely they have duties as well.
I wanna do it right, I wanna do it right away, I wanna do it right now, I wanna do it right away, I wanna do it now.
A life of man. Solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short.
I wanna be a boss, I wanna be a big boss, I wanna boss the world around, I wanna be the biggest boss that ever bossed the world around.
Our guest is Alison McQueen, author of Political Realism in Apocalyptic Times.
Hobbes and the Ideal Citizen.
He already thinks life is nasty, brutish, and long.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help again, now more than ever.
So here's what to do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating. Shouldn't citizens have a say in how they are governed?
Or is that just a recipe for endless extremism and dangerous division?
Is a ruler with absolute power really the only thing that can keep the peace?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're thinking about Thomas Hobbes and the Ideal Citizen.
Hobbes was a great philosopher, Josh, but he was also kind of a provocative one. He said that life in the state of nature without the government intact would be, get this, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. And that's the only reason we need a state.
Wait, did you say British? What's wrong with being British?
No, I didn't say British. I said brutish.
Okay, that's better. But, you know, I still don't buy Hobbes's view, Ken. I mean, what is this stuff about the state of nature? He thinks the state of nature would be solitary, but human beings are naturally social creatures. You know, in the state of nature, maybe we'd live like chimpanzees or something in small social groups.
So I'm going to grant you that, you know, biologically speaking, human beings are to a large degree social animals. But here's something else we do that most animals don't do. We fight with one another like heck. I mean, that's why Hobbes said that life would be brutish and short without the state. I mean, if we lived in a state of nature, we'd be constantly in danger. Come on, of being attacked by other humans, killed by other humans, robbed by other humans, you name it.
No, I don't agree with that. I mean, look, we're not just social animals, Ken. We're also cooperative animals. We band together to get things done. We work with one another to create stuff we couldn't create on our own. I mean, and okay, we fight sometimes, but it's not usually to the death.
Oh, Josh, come on. You're saying that from a very safe and secure perch in a highly developed state with tons and tons of arms. Come on.
Sure, but what are you getting at?
Well, come on. Just think about it. We have laws against things like theft and assault and murder. And you could get incarcerated for a long time if you're caught breaking those laws. But without the state being ever vigilant, without its coercive power to punish wrongdoers, come on, all bets would be off. You got to admit that, Josh.
You mean to tell me the only thing that's stopping you from going around killing other people is that, yeah, you could get locked up for it? I'm starting to feel a little nervous sitting next to you, Ken.
I wouldn't go that far. But look, Josh, I have a question for you. Now, answer honestly. Do you lock your doors at night?
Of course I do. I live in San Francisco.
So, even with all those laws and all that, those police and the courts and the prison, you still fear other people, don't you? Don't you? And you would fear them even more. Come on, admit it. If there were none of those things to protect you.
I wasn't necessarily advocating anarchy.
Okay, well, that's a good thing.
But Hobbes's crazy view of the state of nature leads him to a crazy view of the state. He thinks there's supposed to be a single ruler who has all the power. And what about the rest of us? We're just supposed to obey.
Well, there I'm going to agree with you. I actually think that, although living in Hobbes's actual state, that would be the nasty and brutish thing. And if you disagreed with the ruler, maybe pretty short, too.
Yeah, that's true. You know, you wouldn't really be a citizen. I mean, you'd be a citizen in name, but that's it. In reality, you're basically a subject at the mercy of an all-powerful ruler.
Let's back to this British thing. Aren't you British?
Guilty as charged, my good man.
So aren't you a subject? And aren't you at the mercy of Her Majesty the Queen, Josh? Come on.
I may be a subject of the Queen, but I'm a citizen of the United Kingdom. The Queen has very little power, and I get to vote for my government.
Oh, yeah? How's that working out for you these days, Josh?
Don't kick a man when he's down, Ken. I mean, at least we have the right to choose our leaders and have some say in the laws of the land.
Well, you're right. Hobbes has a very different idea about what it means to be a citizen. And as it turns out, so do ordinary citizens. So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shireen Otto, to ask people on the streets of Oakland and San Francisco about their ideals of citizenship. She files this report.
What does it mean to you to be a citizen?
The ability to do whatever you want to your heart's content.
I think to respect the laws and do your part to make sure that there's a legacy left for people that come behind us.
Being an active part of your community in a positive way, looking out for your neighbors.
Being a citizen means that you have the equal rights that other people in your community do, and that the government would be willing to stand up for you the same way.
The word citizen comes from a French word that originally meant being an inhabitant of a city or town. But being an inhabitant does not always mean having rights.
We have to choose someone.
Why just us?
We represent all the great houses, but whomever we choose, they won't just rule over lords and ladies. Maybe the decision about what's best for everyone should be left to, well, everyone.
Maybe we should give the dogs a vote as well.
I'll ask my horse.
That's a scene from the final episode of Game of Thrones. Though the show is fantasy, there are many historical examples where the idea that ordinary people could have a say in governance was laughable. But for every king and queen that balked at giving their subjects the right to vote, there were ancient societies that had really advanced ideas of citizenship.
For a Greek citizen, it really was intimately engaged with, wrapped up with, your everyday life.
Josiah Ober is a political science and classics professor at Stanford.
It wasn't simply a matter of going and voting every 4 years or every 2 years. It wasn't simply a matter of writing letters to a representative.
Over 2,500 years ago, Athenian citizens went to assemblies 40 times a year. Most of them were also picked from a lottery at least once in their lives to spend a year working full-time in government. It's like jury duty, but for a whole year. And they made decisions about everything.
Everything. War, peace, economic policy, welfare policy. How do we make sure that the streets stay clean? Should we build new warships? You name it.
And then they would go back to their homes and jobs and be responsible for implementing those policies as workers, soldiers, property owners.
So the whole point of citizenship for a classical Greek was that you were not a subject. In Aristotle's terms, you ruled and you were ruled over in your turn.
But it wasn't perfect. Not all people had equal rights. To be a citizen, you had to be a man with parents who were citizens. Women were not citizens. Many people were even owned as slaves. As political powers shifted and empires grew, gradually, over a few hundred years, the ancient Greek system disappeared. But it is the basis for modern-day democracy. Except cities and states got a lot bigger.
So it's much harder for people to interact with a wide range of members of the community in these sort of face-to-face interactions.
Emily Chapman is one of Josiah Ober's political science colleagues at Stanford. She says because people couldn't spend the same amount of time participating in politics, voting became central to the idea of citizenship. But there are also other ways to engage.
Demonstrations, campaigning, donating one's time to sort of organizing. Those sorts of things are all crucial activities of citizenship.
But which activities are considered acceptable has changed over time, like protesting, for example.
If you look at surveys among Americans in the 1960s, A lot of people basically say that it's not an acceptable form of political participation. But then, like, over the course of a couple of decades, you see this shifting where people come by the 1990s to see protest as being a normal and legitimate way of exercising your rights or powers as a citizen to try and influence the public rules.
Chapman says one of the things that might influence people's attitudes about protesting and demonstrating is that it's open to everyone, even if the person doesn't have official citizenship. And that can be a sign of a healthy democracy.
Even if it's not a kind of formal role in decision making, I mean, in well-functioning democracies, the rights of free speech are extended to non-citizens as well.
And that's crucial for creating a culture in which democracy is able to flourish.
Democracy is coming to the USA.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shireen Hyden.
So, Shireen, thanks for that amazing tour of both the history and the current situation with respect to citizenship in many places around the world. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today we're thinking about Hobbes and the ideal citizen.
We're joined now by Allison McQueen, who is a professor of political science at Stanford University and author of Political Realism in Apocalyptic Times. Allison, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you're a political scientist, and that, you know, makes perfect sense to me why you'd be interested in general and justifications for the state. But why do you find Hobbes in particular so interesting?
You know, I didn't always. I thought Hobbes was the philosopher of doom and gloom. I had to write a paper on him in grad school, and I found that I wasn't looking forward to it. And it was on one of those fall days in upstate New York that starts as summer and ends as winter.
Oh, my God.
And it got to the end of the night, and I realized I'd become so engrossed in Hobbes that I hadn't recognized that the temperature had just plummeted. And I took my temperature, and I realized I actually had mild hypothermia.
Oh, God, Allison. Thus began your love for Hobbes. Huh?
Thus began my love for Hobbes. I thought, this guy must have something going on.
Okay, well, that's an awesome story. So look, we just heard from a roving philosophical reporter and lots of different ideas about what it means to be a citizen. But tell me, what does it mean for Hobbes? Since he believes in this kind of absolute state, I'm curious about what's a citizen in his view?
For Hobbes, to be a citizen is simply to be a subject. And so we heard from my colleague Josiah Ober that there's this ancient tradition where you couldn't be a citizen and a subject at the same time. To be a citizen meant to participate in politics. And for Hobbes, that's just nonsense.
Wait a minute, that's just nonsense. Why does he think that? I mean, the Game of Thrones quote, right? He sounds like one of these Game of Thrones guys. Is that what he was, one of these Game of Thrones guys? Well, I should just consult my horse. You want to consult the people? Consult my horse. Consult the dog. Was it the dog?
So he thinks it's ridiculous that people should have any say in how they're governed?
It's not so much ridiculous for Hobbes as dangerous. Once people have a say in how they're governed, when they disagree with one another, it is a swift road to civil war.
And that's what he'd seen in his own time, obviously, in England.
That is indeed what he'd seen. His country had lived through a brutal and disruptive civil war.
Okay, I think of Hobbes as a really great philosopher. I think of him as one of the founding fathers of modern political theory. But that seems like he let his imagination of the possibilities for human life be completely conditioned by the historical moment. I mean, seriously? That there could not be? You look at, there were Roman citizens, there were Greek citizens.
Right, he knew about ancient Greece.
He knew about all that stuff. They didn't collapse in the Civil War.
That's right, but just think about how you might feel, how you might be as a philosopher if you saw your country torn apart by one of the most gruesome conflicts of the time, where people were slaughtering their neighbors, families turning against families. Doing philosophy in an age of extremes leads to completely different conclusions than the ones we might reach today.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Thomas Hobbes and his view of the ideal citizen with Stanford political scientist Allison McQueen.
What qualities make somebody a good citizen? Is obedience a virtue, or could dissent be something we prize? And what kinds of citizens are the most dangerous to social harmony?
Obedience, citizenship, and absolute power when Philosophy Talk continues.
I would keep
Well, of course it's good to be king, but is it good to be a citizen under an all-powerful sovereign? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and we're thinking about Hobbes and his view of the ideal citizen. Our guest is Alison McQueen from Stanford University, author of Political Realism in Apocalyptic Times.
So, Alison, okay, so Hobbes did not see any distinction between being a subject and being a citizen, as you said. That doesn't comport much with anybody, what our people in our roving report had to say. They all had these ideas that seem very un-Hobbesian. So, okay, let's start with Hobbes, though. What would make someone a good or bad citizen for Hobbes? I'm guessing that to be a good citizen is kind of be like a sheep.
Well, you're right there. To be a good citizen for Hobbes means virtually complete obedience to an absolute state. And that may seem really extreme, but Hobbes thought we faced a stark choice between, on the one hand, the war of all against all and the state of nature, life without government, and on the other, peace at the hands of an absolute sovereign. And I know what I'd choose out of those two.
Well, if those are your only choices. But let's go back to something Josh said in the beginning. Did anybody ever say to Hobbes, you know, the English Civil War, that's because, you know, there's the Protestant and the Catholics and all this turmoil and all these factions. That's not the state of nature. It's not that life in the state of nature would be nasty, brutish, and short. It would be nasty, British, and short, because the Brits were at that time at each other's throats. But people aren't always only at each other's throats. Where have people always only been at each other's throats?
I mean, that's an interesting thing, right? Because, you know, we've got, he's the first person in the West. I mean, Mosu in China came up with the idea of the state of nature, but Hobbes is the first person in the West. He wasn't the only person to have an idea of state of nature. Rousseau had a very different picture, which is, yes, you know, Candyland, hippie town, whereas his is Mad Max. Yeah. Well, you know, why should we think that the state of nature is Mad Max?
Well, I think Hobbes asked us to think about some worldly analogs, some examples of where we might be in a condition like that. And one, you're right, civil war, what he'd seen in his own time. Another was, he thought, how states interact with one another on the world stage. It's anarchy. They do whatever they can.
Well, that's true. So, okay, so states, but even they are constrained by one another because they can't do just anything. I mean, the state of states, there's war and it breaks out, and sometimes war is useful, but often states want to avoid a war with, especially wars that they can't win. That doesn't drive them to create a state of state that has all powers. That would be weird. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out how much of Hobbes' philosophy depends on what seems to me like a questionable assumption.
Well, it might help us to make it less questionable, okay, if we think what he actually means by war in the state of nature. And one of the things he says is, I don't mean that people are at each other's throats all the time. What I mean is that in the absence of any kind of guarantee of peace, there's always the threat of war. So think about living in that circumstance of permanent anxiety, always worried that war could break out. And Hobbes asks us to think about whether that's really a condition that makes for a good life.
And it's something, I go back to something you were saying earlier, Ken, you know, we lock our doors.
Yeah.
I mean, if there were no coercive authority, no arbiter of our disputes, then how could I would be terrified at night, and my terror might lead me to, I don't know, recruit some security, and pretty soon,
oh yeah, but
you got armies.
Yeah. Let's grant something. States are good things by and large. I mean, they screw things up because, you know, if you're worried about the war of all against all, well, the war of all states against all states, that's much more destructive than a bunch of snarling individuals, you know, because the state like supercharges war making power. Okay. Let's grant, but states are by and large good things, okay? I grant that. I like living in a state. I don't think I want to live in a stateless world. So the alternative, some anarchists think that the states aren't good things. We should abolish the state. I don't think the only option, alternative to Hobbes is anarchy, right? So there'd be lots of justifications for states and states different from the kind of state Hobbes envisioned, short of anarchy. Don't you agree with that?
That's right. So you might think about one of the alternatives that emerged in both Britain and America, the alternative of limited government.
Right.
You know, look, we all agree that if we follow certain rules, it will lead to peace. Why don't we just agree on the rules that ought to be followed, and hold our leaders to account for following those rules as well. And we obey them only to the extent they follow those rules. Well, Hobbes thinks the problem with that is people are going to disagree on how to interpret those rules, and they're going to disagree on whether the rules have been breached in a particular case. And when people disagree about that, you're on a swift road back to civil war.
So you're saying that a president might commit some kind of violations, and some people might claim that the president didn't violate the Constitution? That's crazy talk.
Look, surely there will be disagreements, right? Surely. And some disagreements will surely, might surely devolve into war of all against all. I mean, think of America and its war over slavery and states' rights and all that stuff and the Union and whether it to be preserved. That was clearly a collapse of the constitutional order. Or think of the former Yugoslavia, right? Where when that state collapsed, it was a war of all against all.
Or think of France in the 16th century.
Right. So there are lots of examples that Hobbes is right. But here's the question I guess I have for you. Okay, maybe you want a state that has a monopoly on, let's call it political power. I'm not sure what the sphere of the political is for Hobbes, but if I lived in a Hobbesian state, would the state tell me every, govern every single aspect of my life? Is it totalitarian in the way that, you know, like Big Brother is totalitarian in 1984? Or is there just, is he saying he's got a monopoly on political power, but there's other kinds of things that where the state has no business interfering?
That's a really good question. For Hobbes, the state and its representative, the sovereign, has the right to make war and peace. It has the right to pass laws. It has the right to punish you and reward you. Importantly, it has the right as well to dictate the meaning of scripture and to tell you how to worship.
No separation of church and state there, right?
No separation of church and state for Hobbes, no. We do, for Hobbes, importantly, retain one right that we can never give up, and that is the right of self-defense. And so it leads to this interesting possibility that your state could put you to death for a crime, could command you to die, and for Hobbes, you would be within your right to try and wrestle the axe out of the executioner's
what about,
hand.
What about the right to marry who I want to marry? For example, which we take as a personal freedom, do I have, or to go to school, go to the university of my choice, right? So there's lots of things in my life that I decide on the basis of my private, personal ambitions, desires. I'm trying to figure out where the state, where the power, okay, it's got all political power, but I want to know how I'd make a divide between the powers that it has as political and the powers that I have just over governing my life.
A lot of that for Hobbes will be contingent on how disruptive those decisions of yours would be for the society at large. If you live in a society with fraught disagreement over marriage and over who can marry whom, then you marrying someone who would be controversial.
Right, like of the same gender as me or of a different race.
Yeah, Hobbes asks us to take seriously that if that has public consequences, if that's likely to be disruptive, if that's likely to get people protesting on the streets, then the sovereign can dictate who you can marry.
That's fascinating. I mean, one of the things that I've always been interested in is the reaction to Leviathan. Bishop Bramall called it a rebel's catechism, right? And so we tend to think about Hobbes as kind of coercive, right? Having a rather oppressive vision of the state. But if you think of it in its context, you might think, well, okay, yeah, you can't marry someone in a situation, you can't marry who you want in a situation where it might be a threat to the peace. But otherwise, you're free to do what you want. Hobbes seemed pretty egalitarian when it came to gender. He thought that, you know, women and men were on an equal footing. Women could certainly be rulers.
That's right.
He was a contractarian. He thought that the state had to be legitimated by the implicit consent of the state. So is it really sort of tyrannical as it might seem?
Yes, it shocks us today to imagine that some of Hobbes's respondents actually thought that his theory wasn't authoritarian enough.
Right.
right?
Exactly.
But if you think about it, the fact that he allows us that residual right of self-defense, the fact that he thinks that government is in some way founded on a contract between free and equal individuals, that was, for Bishop Bramall, the recipe for rebellion in Hobbes's authoritarian theory.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about Hobbes and the ideal citizen. Lisa from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lisa. What's your comment or question?
Yes, I'm Chilean-American, and I want to give a shout-out to the example of citizen action in Chile happening these days, not only in the very brave protesting, but all against what basically is a civil dictatorship, because the Constitution under which they've been under for these past 30 years has been one that was drafted by a dictatorship government, but also the economic situation involved there, the neoliberal economic model under which they've been subjected to has privatized the entire country. So there are popular assemblies going on right now to these where citizens throughout the entire country are meeting, are getting together, gathering and talking in different neighborhoods and discussing the formation of what's called a constitutional assembly in order to create a new constitution. And this is happening right now.
So the
whole idea of the commons, the whole idea of pushing back against this privatization model, which has privatized the entire country.
Thanks a lot for the input, Lisa. She's raising an interesting question. I'm going to bring it back to Hobbes. Would such kind of citizen activism, citizen engagement, citizen like resistance, is there any grounds for that in a Hobbesian view?
No, there's really not. And as we've seen, I think Hobbes's context matters for explaining his intuitions. If you live through a civil war, you might be willing to put up with a lot of authoritarianism in the name of peace. And you might think one of the assets that Hobbes might have seen to giving the political leader, the sovereign, all these rights to police public discourse and public action is that actually none of us would know whether our co-citizens, our co-subjects, were unhappy with the regime, because no one would be talking about it.
Yeah. So look, Hobbes then is very far, his notion of a citizen is very far from anything that's in the ether of our common political life. But there's a strange thing that you said, which I kind of puzzle about this. You said he's like the kind of official philosophical beginning of the social contract tradition, which is at the core of American political thinking, of
exactly.
Our founding fathers and all that sort of stuff. You know, it gives rise to Jefferson saying it's with the consent of the governed, and we have the right to withhold that consent. I mean, that clearly doesn't come from Hobbes, right? So where does it come from, and why do we think of Hobbes? I mean, is Hobbes the beginning of political liberalism? Is he not a political liberal? Is he some kind of halfway house? He seems like a strange dude in the history of political thought.
Yeah, it may seem surprising that he makes any contribution to liberalism at all.
Right.
And perhaps we can say he does so inadvertently, right?
Despite himself, eh?
he's certainly the first real canonical thinker to offer a social contract argument. They'd been in the ether, but he takes it and he puts it on steroids. So he gives us this argument. It's a powerful argument that government is legitimate if it arose or could have arisen from the consent of free and equal parties. And that becomes one of the cornerstones of the liberal tradition. And you're right. It motivates Jefferson. It motivates the other American founders.
Where does he get the idea? He seems to have the idea that once we consent, that's it. It's over. You can't withdraw your consent. That consent can't be violated. Then, once you consent, then you start obeying. I mean, that doesn't seem to follow. Why does he think it follows? I don't think of Hobbes as a philosopher devoid of imagination who doesn't ask himself hard questions. I think of him as really a first-rate philosopher. So where does he get this thought that, once you consent, that's it?
I think it might help to reframe the place of the social contract argument in his thought. It's not that he's saying as a historical matter we were all wandering around in the woods and then decided to enter into an agreement to form a government with one another and then we're bound for all time afterward. You can think of it as a nice thought experiment you can do. If you're sitting in your society and you're thinking, oh, these laws look a bit onerous, or the sovereign is asking me to do things that I'm not sure about, he asks you to think to yourself, imagine what life would be like without government, and it would be really terrible. And could you imagine a situation where you might consent to be ruled by an absolute state to get out of that condition of war? And so it's a nice check.
But wait a minute, wouldn't I want some constraints on that state? Wouldn't I want to say, yeah, that's the, you even said the right of self-defense doesn't abandon, all right? Well, the right to speak my mind, right? Okay, I may not, you may not have to do what I say, but you have to hear what I say. Why not?
Well, that's not a thought Hobbes had, but it is a thought that someone writing a generation later did
have. Right, exactly. So I'm trying to figure out why, I don't want to just attribute it to Hobbes' lack of imagination that he didn't. I'm just wondering what in his mind prevented him from going those extra steps.
I think what prevented him was just how bad he thought the state of nature was, how bad the Civil War had been. And if he thought, if we can all acknowledge what a terrible condition that is,
right. Then... I gotcha. So we've got a caller. Ariana, be succinct for me, okay? Thanks.
Yeah, I think that one important point to make is that the state has the right to legitimize its own violence, and so it also enhances anxiety and encourages people to overly rely on the state to produce solutions to very layered problems. So we see, like, the problem of education, where people have to have money to have a good education. We see a media that disinforms and controls and creates a consumerist populace, and where capitalism supersedes democracy. And if it were a good government and if it were reformed, and it hopefully it will be in the process of being reformed as people become engaged citizens, but as it is now, within this late stage model, we have people who are complacent,
yeah,
and who are willing to let the planet die because other people are
Ariana, thanks for the input. I'm going to try and give Allison a chance to respond. I'm going to put a kind of tighten the question just a little bit. I mean, Ariana's pointing out some ways in which states can be radically imperfect and can do really bad things. You know, I mean, if you're in a monarchy, you can have a tyrannical king, and you might think, it doesn't seem as though Hobbes thought about the ways in which states can go wrong, especially when you endow them with this absolute sovereignty. It doesn't seem as though he gave much thought about, like, how to constrain the state power.
That's exactly right. If we want to think of Hobbes as doom and gloom on the nature of humanity, he was an incorrigible optimist about political leaders.
He thought they were going to be great, right?
He thought they would be ennobled by the office.
Right.
Really? Oh, my God. Somebody said that about a current occupant of a high office. Mm. That person would grow into it. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about citizenship and the political philosophy of Thomas Hobbes with Allison McQueen from Stanford University.
What kind of qualities would an absolute ruler need in order to heal today's deep partisan divide? Do you agree with Hobbes that absolute state authority is the answer to political division? Or is the idea of an absolute ruler absolutely outdated?
Hobbes and the modern political state when Philosophy Talk continues. One by one, bowing to the crown. Is that really how an ideal citizen ought to behave? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Laddie. Our guest is Stanford political scientist Allison McQueen. Today we're asking about Hobbes, citizenship, and the state.
So, Allison, okay, I'm going to concede. I'm not a Hobbesian, but I can concede that Hobbes' view about absolute power of the state made some sense, maybe lots of sense, given the times in which he was writing, given the problem that he saw. You know, how do we prevent the equivalent of the English Civil War from breaking out all over again everywhere? But really, seriously, do they have any relevance? Any relevance whatsoever to today's political realities?
Well, I think they do. I mean, as you pointed out, the existential threat of Hobbes's time was the Civil War tearing Britain apart. The existential threat of our time is climate change. And so we see people today, this group that's gaining increasing strength of people who call themselves eco-authoritarians, who think we face a stark choice. We face a stark choice between planetary emergency and collapse on the one hand, and effective rule by experts and maybe even political strongmen on the other.
And of course, it's not just the eco-authoritarians. There's plenty of just, you know, plain old-fashioned authoritarians.
Yeah, we did a show recently on the allure of authoritarianism, right. And I will grant you that authoritarianism has a certain allure. I will grant you that.
And you might say, in Hobbesian terms, especially in times of crisis where people cannot agree even on the facts.
Right, but to say it has an allure is not to say it's an... here's something I've said before, deeply believe that we in Western liberal democracies have deluded ourselves for a long time, partly because of the outcome of the world wars and the Cold War. We thought, oh, look, we won. Our ideals won. They triumphed. And in some ways, they did triumph. In some ways, they did. But mainly because those states that tried the other ideal, because of the contingencies of history. Hitler made, if you watch that movie Lifeboat, which was made at the beginning of the war with Alfred Hitchcock, it puts really the question urgently. Who's got it? Who's got the better idea, the Germans or the Allied powers? And it's not at all clear. I mean, Hitchcock is toying with the ideas that the Germans have it right because that German sergeant on that boat is the guy in control who can get things done.
Yes.
Right, and the other people are bickering and they can't unite and all this stuff. Okay, and then Hitler made this stupid mistake. He didn't listen to his generals at Moscow. Stalin sent 6 or 8, divisions to reinforce. He had smashed the Red Army in the West, but he made this mistake. Okay. The contingencies of history.
What's your point, Ken?
That my point is that it's not... obvious to me that democracy, liberal democracy, is the better, is the more...
More
effective form of social life, social political life, than these totalitarian regimes. I don't think history has settled that. I grant you that. But I don't think there's much of a case to be made that it's been settled in favor of the authoritarians.
So even in an emergency, as Allison was saying, climate change is an emergency.
Right.
I'd be
really reluctant to do that. So tell me why I'm wrong to think this way.
I don't necessarily think you are wrong. So one of the reasons we could read Hobbes is because we want to see the strong case for authoritarianism made by one of the best philosophers in the canon. But another reason to read Hobbes is to figure out why we might be committed to very different ideals. I mean, I read Hobbes and I disagree with him utterly, but it gives me someone to fight with. It gives me a reason to think about what the grounds are for liberal democratic commitments and how I would defend them against a thinker with arguments as powerful as Hobbes's.
Yeah, I get you.
Proust said the best way to figure out your own position is to read someone really smart that you disagree with.
Yeah. We got a caller, Larry from Fremont. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Larry. What's your comment or question?
Hi. I have some comments about Hobbes' view of the citizen versus the sovereign. It seems that he is separating these things. What if the citizen is the sovereign, but that the sovereign does not run the country? The sovereign hires highly paid consultants to run the country for them.
Thanks for the question, Larry. Allison, what do you make of what Larry had to say there?
Well, this is the big development that happens after Hobbes's time, that there isn't a distinction between citizen and sovereign, that you get the rise of an idea of popular sovereignty. The sovereign is us. And that puts on us the responsibility to think about how we want to wield political power.
But there is a germ of that idea even in Hobbes, right? Because we're in the state of nature. Nobody has any authority over us. And the way they get authority over us is we say... together, hey, let's have a state. Let's get the whale to govern us.
That's exactly right. And what we also say is we are from now on going to view ourselves as the author of that state's actions. And so when the state shows up at your door in that Leviathan society to arrest you for a crime, you're not supposed to say to yourself, well, this is all a bit much. You're supposed to say, there's no injustice here.
Wait a minute. Can't I say, this is what I agreed to? I can't ever say, wait a minute, I'm not sure I agreed to that. And then doesn't the state have to, like, defend that? Yes, that's what you agreed to.
No, you don't, because part of what you agree to for Hobbes is to alienate your own will and your own judgment about what is necessary to peace and give it up to the leader who's going to represent
the
state.
Like, you're making the state sound like a really awful thing. I'm like, who would want to live that way? Okay, I know the alternative is worse, but I want to ask you something else about the state. One of the things I think about the state and legitimate state is the state is cool because it's a sphere of extended cooperation within political life, especially when we agree about means and ends. I mean, that's hard, but we deliberate about them and then we agree about them. And then all of a sudden, I'm not on my own, but our collectivity can provide health insurance for all of us. Dream on. In some collectivities, we say we're going to mutually benefit each other. So that's an extended sphere of rational cooperation, of living together. The state facilitates that. Hobbes seems to believe something like that because in the state, he says in the state of nature, there's no navigation, there's no industry, there's no arts, right? In the state, there are these things. So what's up with that, right?
You're right. Amazing things happen when we get together and we create this entity called the state. And Hobbes, in that way, that's where our power resides for Hobbes. There's nothing natural about the state. It is a product of artifice. We make it.
Right.
And it allows us to do these extraordinary things, as you point out. But it's only going to allow those things to happen if it can effectively project political force and if it can do so to ensure peace.
So how much of this depends on something we were saying earlier about the belief in the goodness of the monarch, right, or of the sovereign? I mean, Hobbes, as you were saying earlier, seems to be irrepressibly optimistic about that. That once you take office, you'll realize that your own flourishing and security depends on everyone being happy, and so you'll become a good monarch. And maybe he was thinking of Elizabeth I or something like that. But hadn't he seen a bunch of English monarchs not being so great? I mean, you know, I wouldn't mind living maybe in a society like this, right, where maybe I alienate my will to the state and the state gets things done because it's bigger than the sum of its parts, if I could trust that the leader of that state was going to do what's best for all of us. Did Hobbes really think that we could trust that?
I think he did, but I don't think we have to think that along with Hobbes. So if we want to subject Hobbes to the ultimate test, what we should ask of Hobbes is whether the solution of absolute sovereignty is worse than the problem it's meant to solve, the anarchy of the state of nature. And he thought the solution was better than the problem it was meant to solve. We don't share that intuition.
Well, I don't know about this. I mean, let's try that a little differently. I think I see where you're going, but okay, there's the state of nature. Let's suppose Hobbes is right. That's really terrible. There's a solution to the state of nature, absolute political authority in the hands of the state. That's better than that. But isn't there something between the state of nature, which is awful, and absolute authority, unquestioned authority, which is also awful? Isn't there some middle ground that gives us a state, but with limited powers, with constraints on it, such that I gather a subject has, there's many different things that a subject is, but a subject does not have a complaint against the sovereign. Right. You are a subject. You are not citizen. You are not equal. You don't make the laws. You obey. A subject does not have a complaint against the sovereign. A citizen has a complaint against the state. Right. That's why we have this idea of political rights that can't be abridged, even by the state, even by the majority. He didn't.
That's exactly right. That seems like a very intuitive idea to us, that Hobbes's theory has a missing middle.
Right.
Right. And that middle could be filled in with forms of limited government or divided rule. Systems that give citizens a lot of ways to hold their leaders accountable. Now, one thing to think about is there weren't in Hobbes's time a lot of examples of states like that that had remained stable over time. Maybe Hobbes would have reached a very different conclusion if he'd been able to see, for instance, the fate of Britain or America.
Yeah, but John Locke saw a lot of the same things. But he's like the avatar of limited government and all that, right? So what's the difference?
The right to rebellion.
Yeah.
Yeah, for John Locke, the lessons of the Civil War were very different. It was a lesson in the dangers of absolute rule.
Exactly.
Charles I's absolute rule had partly led to the Civil War in the first place. And Locke very astutely insists that our solution to the problems of the state of nature ought not to be worse than the problem it's meant to solve.
So one was a grouch or something. I don't know. I mean, there was some philosopher like Hume was a bon vivant and a well-lived fellow. Was Hobbes a grouch? Last thought. Was he a grouch or was he an optimistic dude or what?
We might think he was, but actually he was a pretty fun guy.
Jeepers. Well, on that puzzling note, Allison, I'm going to thank you. This has not been nasty or brutish. It has been too short, though. But thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Allison McQueen. She's a professor of political science at Stanford University. She's author of Political Realism in Apocalyptic Times. So, Josh, what are you thinking now? We didn't get to talk to Allison about the apocalypse. So that's really interesting
stuff
in the work. But anyway, what are you thinking now?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, there's a lot in Hobbes that I can't agree with. But the idea that we should think from a position of the worst is very interesting. Like, what's the worst that could happen if we didn't live under the system we do now? Mm. And, you know, the idea that maybe we should be thinking about valuing life, right? That the problem with the state of nature is lives are going to be held cheap.
You know, one of the things I love about doing shows, episodes like this, and teaching stuff like Hobbes and all these great dead thinkers, is that we are so locked in the present. So many of our imaginations are kind of a sterile presentism. We don't think ideas emerge from anywhere, but the idea of political liberalism emerged over time.
Yes.
And it began with a thinker who was not at all a political liberal, but the dialectic of history led to political liberalism. And I think it's so important for people to understand that everything in the human world emerges. It doesn't just ever come like fully formed from one person's head.
And I'll say this as a literature person. It involves imagination, you know? Hobbes needed to imagine a totally different kind of world and think through metaphors, even though he didn't like metaphors officially. But he was full of metaphors and he was full of these imaginary scenarios, and that's how he got to where he ended up.
This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, with no apologies to Descartes, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in our community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, or if you're bedeviled by a conundrum in your life and could use some philosophical insight, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at conundrums@philosophytalk.org.
And now, nasty? Well, maybe. Brutish? Sometimes. Short? As fast as possible. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes. When Thomas Hobbes is coming up, Western ways of thinking were moving away from the long efforts to reconcile the old Greeks with modern Christian thinking. After all, the bloom had come off the Christian rose. Many Christians weren't even Catholic anymore. The modern world was heating into view, a world still in fear of God, sure, but growing more connected to kings, ships, and goods than dogma. Writing in the 17th century, Thomas Hobbes claimed that unchecked freedom could lead us into wars that could kill us all. If we acknowledge our vainglory, we can use our autonomy to trade liberty for the security of authority, to Leviathan, as it's termed in his magnum opus. In it, Hobbes is said to have invented the modern state and to make the claim that the best use of our freedom is to lose it in the consent to be governed. Now, this is the time of chaos in England, Protestants and Catholics, Roundheads and Cavaliers, Civil War. Fearing for his safety, Hobbes had moved to France in 1640. Ahead of publication, he presented a copy of Leviathan to Prince Charles, living in exile, hoping for his favor. But his suggestion that subjects had the right to abandon rulers who could not protect them offended the prince's advisors, barred from the court, and under suspicion by France for his attacks on the church, he moved back to England in 1751, making peace with the New England under the regime of fanatically anti-Catholic Oliver Cromwell. Now, the rule of Cromwell seems to both prove and disprove Hobbes. Liberty led to chaos, which led to Cromwell, who became the state, which led to a major war in Ireland, a land grab from Catholic farm owners, an influx of carpet-begging Protestant English, and the birth of the Troubles, as the Irish so whimsically term them. Then came the Restoration, and Hobbes returned to favor with a new king, Charles II. He scandalized the bishops, but the king liked his wit. Then in 1666, the House of Commons made a bill against atheism, making Hobbes feel a little threatened, him being a rabid materialist and all, but he burned a few papers that he thought might compromise him and morphed into a wise and witty old man, the kind everybody wants at the dinner party. He lived to be 91. In his late 80s, he wrote his autobiography, in verse, in Latin. This is the sort of thing that kings used to expect from their learned subjects now. The state just wants everybody to shut up. So Hobbes might have invented the state, and obviously he was leery of religion. Did he also invent the deep state? He proved to be adept at avoiding clutches and thriving in both chaos and statehood. the question he posed of liberty versus security proves still to be the governmental rub. Also, do we even always know if we're free or not? Are we free to do a thing or just allowed to do it? Liberty at a whim seems to be the deal these days, ask the seekers at our borders. And today we face special challenges to Leviathan. You would think President Trump would be the perfect embodiment of this Hobbesian state. The trouble is, he seems to be the best of the state mingled with the worst of the governed. That is, he is vainglorious and impulsive. And there is no state to rein in his whims. Well, there is, but he ignores it. And that's not all the flies in the ointment of the Hobbesian utopia that never came to be. Take Brexit. The decision to join the European Union was a decision made by states to join a larger state for the purposes of trade. Then England, the state, based on a vote by its citizens, the governed, decided to leave the Union in a move now known as Brexit. That break has become bogged down in the weeds created in England by the commingling of states. But should it finally come to pass, there will be many obstacles, not the least of which the Republic of Ireland would remain in the European Union. Northern Ireland would leave, along with the rest of the UK. So 2020 might set the stage for troubles we could have nipped in the bud way back in 1640. So yes, it may be true that without the benefit of state, lives can be nasty, brutish, and short, as Hobbes famously wrote. But states themselves, as history shows, are also nasty and brutish. They just last a little longer. That's all. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2019.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Leviathan is everywhere. Leviathan is everyone. And Leviathan is coming.